Hello, Katie in Paris.
Hello, Dominic in Amsterdam. Listeners, we have a confession to make. For our inaugural episode, despite the whole point of our podcast being that we are in different places and that gives us a kind of pan-European appeal, we're actually sitting in the same room right now. We're here together in Liverpool.
Yay!
It's really nice here.
It is really nice here.
We've been here for the birthday of a friend last night, which is something else we have to apologise for because I think we're both sounding a little hoarse.
Katie does sound like a little hoarse, but I actually only sound hoarse because I've got a cold. Obviously, I was very responsible as an opera singer and didn't get really drunk last night.
You went home super early. It's kind of lame.
Thanks.
But in a nice way. Well done.
So, Katie, why don't you tell us why we're here?
What we wanted to do was have a podcast that talks to people all over Europe about what's been going on there. And in a kind of soppy way, I guess, kind of help to bring Europe together a bit more. Maybe by doing that.
Oh.
It's a big dream. But yeah, and I also just wanted to call you up every week.
Yeah, I get that quite a lot. All these people trying to set up podcasts with me, it's exhausting.
So Dominic and I are old friends. I live in Paris now. I'm a journalist there.
And I am Dominic. I'm an opera singer who lives in Amsterdam. I've been living there for nearly 4 years now. But I try and keep that quiet because my Dutch is still heel slecht. I think that means very bad.
That sounded lovely. Yeah.
Katie's assimilated much better into French culture, but I think that's kind of more necessary in France.
I'm literally sitting here wearing a stripy top right now. I'm one step away from having a string of onions around my neck.
She did come in with a baguette under her arm as well.
Anyway, this week for our first ever episode, I think we have a very nice, well-rounded show for you. We're going to be talking about some scientists and bankers who are going to be moving after Brexit.
Then we'll be talking to Frank in Berlin about Merkel's bummer of a week.
And then we're going to be talking to our friend Anya in Poland to talk about the artist Frida Kahlo's relationship with Poland, which is a thing, apparently.
That sounds like a great plan, Katie. So, Katie, we both got good news this week for our respective cities, did we not?
We did indeed. We're feeling very smug about it.
So I'm getting the European Medicines Agency in Amsterdam.
And I'm getting the horrible bankers. Yay!
Yeah,
the
luck.
European Banking Authority is going to be moving to Paris. So this is all after Brexit. There's been a kind of Eurovision-type process going on in the EU the last couple of months with all the different countries in Europe trying to vote on who's going to get these two really big, quite important EU agencies that are currently based in London right now. And yeah, there was this big, complicated, very political Eurovision-type voting process. And what happened in the end? It had to go to like a lucky draw or something.
Well, yeah, with the Medicines Agency, they went through three rounds where I think Milan and Amsterdam were drawn, according to the judges. So they ended up pulling it out of a hat. And Amsterdam won.
Do you think all these scientists who are coming are going to be happy in Amsterdam?
I think they'll have a great time. And in fact, the agency employees were polled and over 80% of them said that Amsterdam was their first choice, which I can understand why. I mean, it's an amazing place to live.
It is really nice.
But I am a bit surprised as to why Dutch people are so excited about this. Well, I mean, I don't think everyone's like super excited, but they're like patting themselves on the back saying, well done us.
But they weren't like cheering in the street or anything.
They weren't cheering on the street, but they are excited. And I think they shouldn't be too excited because, as Katie and I have discussed before, Amsterdam is so overcrowded. There's no rooms in the hotels. There are all these tourists filling all the streets that mean that we have to have people crowd controlling people just to walk down the streets. It's become quite a serious problem and they're actively dissuading certain types of tourists.
This is the thing, right? Because aren't your authorities quite snobby about the type of tourists that come in? And they're specifically, they don't like the riffraff who come in on stag doos, particularly from Britain, I feel. Yeah. Coming in, dressing up in stupid costumes, going to the red light district, getting wasted and throwing up all over the place.
And are you suggesting that the employees of the European Medical Agency aren't going to do any of those things?
No, they're going to just walk around in their lab coats. At least that's what I'm imagining. But we are looking forward to welcoming all of them onto the show for a joint interview. I think in total for Amsterdam and Paris, it's about 1,000 jobs. So both the cities are really, really happy about it because these are big, high quality jobs and there's going to be quite a lot of investment going on for it. And they're important agencies. The medicine one, which is the one you're getting, Dominic, is like one of the most powerful medicine regulators in the world, I think. It's got a big role in deciding what medicines end up on the shelves of our pharmacies in different countries all over Europe. And the banking authority sounds really boring. It does things called stress tests, which is really fun and interesting. But it's really important, especially after what we've been through on this continent financially in the last 10 years. I think it's probably good that someone, you know, is there making sure everything's okay.
Who's going to be doing that in the UK?
Oh, probably no one. It's probably one of those many things that we haven't decided what we're doing yet. But yeah, no, Paris, again, I don't think there were people out cheering on the street. But I think the president, Emmanuel Macron, was pretty close to coming out and cheering on the street because he's really trying to build up this reputation for Paris as a banking capital. After Brexit, he's made it very clear he wants to like nab loads of banking jobs and bring the banking industry to Paris and say, you know, it's not just Frankfurt that can have bankers.
Is he doing that by offering them special deals?
Yeah, that was literally in his first budget, which has got quite a lot of criticism from left-wing people over how generous it is to rich people. There were specific tax cuts for high-earning finance workers.
Uh-huh.
So that's going to be a thing.
I smell trouble.
I smell money.
You always smell the money, Katie. But there was more bad news, dare I say it, for the UK this week in terms of Brexit, in that the EU made a decision that UK cities will not be eligible to apply to become the European Capital of Culture in 2023. And now this may sound like quite a trivial distraction compared to these big agencies with loads of employment. And maybe it is in the grand scheme of things, but the cities that are awarded this European Capital of Culture can gain huge benefits, as was seen in Liverpool, where Katie and I currently sit, in 2008. The mayor of Liverpool, Jo Anderson, wrote an article in the Huffington Post this week after the news was announced that the UK cities would not be able to apply anymore, in which he talked about how not only was it an incredible chance for the city to show off their creative brilliance, but also it led to real bottom line benefits in terms of their visitor economy and improvements to the city's infrastructure. It's estimated that it made £754 million for the economy, which is quite a lot of dosh.
That's a lot of dosh. Again, I can smell money.
Yeah.
But I don't know, I kind of feel in two minds about this because on the one hand, I do feel really sorry for these towns that spent hundreds of thousands of pounds or euros, that's a currency conversion for you, on their bids for all this stuff. But it was quite clearly in the rules that they wouldn't be eligible. Like you have to be a member of the European Union or a candidate country or a member of the European Economic Area. It was written down in the rule book.
But still, I feel really sad. So as Katie alluded to, there are various cities that had already put an application in for 2023 to the UK government, including Dundee, Leeds, Milton Keynes, Nottingham, and a joint bid from three Northern Irish cities, Belfast, Derry, and Strabane. Is that how you pronounce it? I felt really sad for some of these. I felt particularly sad for Dundee, who just a few weeks ago had this launch of their application in front of the town hall with so much pomp and circumstance, including what looked like some people holding giant letters can-canning, which I didn't realize was a Scottish thing.
Yes, the can-can is native to Dundee. You heard it here first.
Yeah, great.
Shall we give my friend and colleague Frank Zetter a call in Berlin to find out what's been going on there?
Let's.
Hi, Frank. It's Katie.
Hello, Frank.
Hello there.
How's Berlin looking today?
Well, you know, it's classically grey overcast. Oh, no, I see a little bit of blue up in the sky.
Lovely. We just thought we'd give you a ring because, we wanted to know what's going on in Germany, really.
Yeah, it seems like Angela Merkel's had a pretty bad week.
Yeah. We had the eternal Chancellor Merkel before the election, and now some serious doubts about how quickly she'll be able to cobble together a government. Don't know, you know, how much we've been, you guys have been following this recently, but of course we had the election on September 24th, quite a while ago, and this then led to all the mainstream parties basically lost votes to this new far right or right wing populist, whichever you want to call them. Party, the Alternative for Germany, which is against immigration, basically xenophobic and anti-establishment. And as a result, Merkel, although she's still the most popular leader here and scored the best election results, she emerged with a reduced majority and therefore had to go hunting for a new governing partner. Now, her former junior partners, the Social Democrats, immediately said, no, we don't want to once more govern in the shadow of Merkel. We're going into opposition to lick our wounds and rebuild and recover, so we'll do better next time. Merkel had to try to cobble together a coalition with a motley crew of pretty unlikely bedfellows spanning the left to right. On the one hand, you had this liberal pro-business Free Democrats Party, and then on the other side, the left-leaning Green Party. And then, of course, there's Merkel's own Bavarian sister party, the Christian Social Party.
What could go wrong, eh?
This all fell apart last Sunday night when the leader of this small party, the Free Democrats, basically imploded the process for reasons that people still speculate about, but it may have been a kind of opportunistic ploy to heighten his party's chances in a new election. Now, suddenly, you know, Germany, this big economy at the center of Europe, with Merkel, the kind of go-to leader on many global issues increasingly,
right?
Suddenly, you know, no longer has this stable setup, but it's kind of, you know, trying to find a way out of this crisis. After this wobble, Merkel has had to go back to her former junior partners, the Social Democrats, and try to convince them to join her for another 4-year stint after all.
And right now, their boss, Martin Schulz, is under a lot of pressure within his party just to suck it up, put rivalries aside, and go into government with her. But I've got to say, as a Brit, the whole idea of an opposition party doing this just seems so alien, you know? You can't imagine Jeremy Corbyn and the UK Labour Party going into coalition with Theresa May and her Conservatives, but that's roughly equivalent to what we're looking at here. The culture of wanting to forge a consensus and put differences aside is just so strong in Germany.
Yeah, absolutely. There are a lot of issues there, but the idea of a sort of consensus-driven politics has always been pretty strong in Germany. I guess a country with a horrible history that's had all sorts of turmoil inflicted on the world and upon itself in the past, which has kind of shaped this consensus-driven political culture, which, yeah, in the last 4 years led us to have this grand coalition. You know, it's like the Labour and the Tories govern together on America, the Democrats and the Republicans. Absolutely unthinkable, you know, unless you're facing, you know, a national calamity and everybody needs to band together, like Mars attacks or something. It kind of worked here in the last 4 years, but, you know, many critics put this sort of leaden lid over, you know, parliamentary democratic debate. Basically, you had the mainstream parties banding together to run the country with a minimal opposition. And I think this is, you know, another factor that led to the rise of this right-wing populist or far-right party. Mm-hmm. That's what we had the last 4 years, and this is what we're approaching again.
It sounds like quite a difficult strategic decision for the Social Democrats. And we've had echoes of this in the Netherlands, where I live as well, where there was a big grand coalition between the Social Democrats and the traditional Conservative Party. Mm-hmm. And also, in the last election, the Social Democrats decided to rule out going into coalition. But it seems in Germany there's quite a lot of panic about the fact that a coalition hasn't been formed yet, even though it's not been that long. It was the end of September. And I saw in The Guardian today they had this headline saying that there were echoes of the Weimar Republic as German politicians lose the knack for coalition building. Do you get a sense that,
yeah,
that there is panic in Germany, or is that kind of sensationalizing it?
Yeah, far be it from me to critique one of the great newspapers in London, but I think, yeah, that's a headline. I mean, of course, yes, this is an unusual situation, and you know, there is a degree of uncertainty that people aren't comfortable with. To call it panic might be overreaching a little bit. At the moment, it's still all up in the air, but there are more and more voices within the Social Democrats who say, look, we will push a whole list of demands, we'll get a good deal, and we will kind of save the government and do the right thing. Now, this is still far from assured. And, you know, the party itself is deeply split between those who say, no, let's go into opposition and return to our roots as a Labour party, as the working man's party, and those who say, let's do the responsible thing and enter another one of those uneasy coalitions.
That would be the German thing to do, wouldn't it?
Yeah, perhaps.
Frank, I've just got one last question to ask you.
Mm-hmm.
I showed you our website the other day, and you know how we've got this big picture of Angela Merkel with a big rainbow and a big smile on her face. Do you think we're going to need to change our artwork?
Yeah, look, I mean, again, Merkel, until recently described as the eternal chancellor, suddenly looks a little bit wobbly, but talk of her being in the twilight of her reign, no one ever expected her to do more than another four-year term. Whether she'll be able to do that, unclear. What speaks in her favor is that she doesn't have serious challenges gunning for her job just yet. We'll see what happens, but I wouldn't count her out just yet.
Okay, so we'll keep the picture on the website for now then.
Yeah,
okay.
No big changes. Thank you so much, Frank, for speaking to us about this. It's really nice to have a real German perspective.
Thank you very much.
Speak to you soon.
All the best, guys.
I was thinking now we could take a little detour and go over to Poland and give our friend Ania a ring to find out what's been going on there. Because she's just been to an interesting art show about Frida Kahlo's relationship with Poland. Should we give her a call?
Yeah.
Hey, I'm very excited about this podcast. I can't wait for the world to find out about this podcast.
Neither can we, and neither can the world.
Yes, everyone is on tenterhooks. Ania, what are you doing? Are you on a train?
No, I am currently in a restaurant. Actually, this is funny. It's a restaurant in Poznań, which is a city in western Poland, like a four-hour train ride from Warsaw. And it's like kind of a Germany-influenced part of Poland. But to the restaurant that we're in, it specializes in ribs, and it specializes in not offering you a fork and a knife. So they bring you a paper tablecloth, and then they draw a plate and a knife and a fork in like caricature style on your table. And then they bring you bibs that have like also in marker. And then you just eat ribs with your hands and you make a mess out of yourself, kind of like lobster, whatever. But
amazing.
That is, I know, I love it. I just could not stop cackling. I was like, this is amazing. I love this.
But this is like, I think it's quite a good ending to your day that you're running in a restaurant that has a knife and fork and stuff drawn on the table, because you have been in Poznan for an art exhibition. Is that right?
Correct. And it was really great. It was super great. Like we were very impressed, because normally the thing with Poland is the exhibitions, it's not like New York where you have super high quality captions and everything has been curated to the max. In Poland, mm-hmm. sometimes it's hit or miss. It's not always that great. I mean, there have been a few exhibitions that I've seen this year that have been good, but this was just so professionally done. And it was just exciting because Poland in general is, like, you know, the States or France, it doesn't have that much international art, million-dollar name. And this was a Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera exhibition. And there was like, I think, maybe two dozen paintings by them, plus a bunch of drawings. And then they also had the Polish context. That was the whole theme.
Yeah, what is that? So, like, what is the Polish context of Frida Kahlo?
Well, okay, so there's two things. First, she had a student who was Polish-born, and she ended up becoming a painter, and she was one of Frida's four favorite students. So she was actually Polish-born, but then moved to Mexico. So there's a bunch of her art on display, and then there's also a Polish-born photographer who took a lot of photos of Frida, including the photo of her on her deathbed. Part B of the Polish context is funnier, more interesting in my opinion. So Frida painted a bunch of really small paintings. She painted about 150, so not that many paintings, and they're all really tiny, except for this one painting, a little bigger. It's called The Wounded Table, and it shows Frida sitting at a table with a skeleton next to her, because why not? And then the table itself is another version of Frida, and it has like gashes and wounds and all that, because Frida was very wounded from an accident, from polio, etc. So that painting, The Wounded Table, was shown in Poland for the last time in the 50s when there was this big exhibition of Mexican art in Warsaw. And someone stole the painting. Unclear
what?
Who, unclear where. Yes. And it has not been found to this day. So actually at the exhibition today, they had a little box where you could put in, you could write down, if you knew where the painting is, they're like, please tell us. If you know, please tell us.
That's amazing. Such a good idea.
That's so great. Did you write something in the box?
Well, I wanted to. I was standing there with my boyfriend. I'm like, oh, you should write something. He's like, no, this is serious, Anya. This is a serious thing. Like, they want to know. And I was like, I thought this was a joke. So I didn't write anything. I was going to write, like, my backpack. But apparently that wouldn't help. But they did say that it could be in Moscow. So either the Poles stole it or the Russians. Who knows?
Wow.
But, so when was it stolen?
In the 50s.
When Poland was like an annex of the Soviet Union.
Yes, it was communist times, correct. Mm. And that's actually why Frida and Poland, there is a tie. Like, I've read her biography, and in it, there's they quote letters by her in which she says, "I love the people of Poland," and blah, blah, blah. So because of, like, Frida was a huge communist, and so was Diego. And so they felt that tie to Poland, because Poland at the time was a communist country.
This exhibition is on at the Castle Cultural Center in Poznan, is that right?
Centrum Kultury Zamek.
Thank you so much for joining us. I think we should let you get back to your steak now.
Thank you for having me. It was very lovely to talk to you both.
Thank you, Anya.
So now we get to my favorite bit of this podcast, which I'm still searching for a name for, but currently the working title is Dominic's Happy Ending. It's a bit of good news at the end of the podcast about Europe that you may have missed. If anyone has a less offensive or less salacious term.
We want a more salacious term, actually.
Do we?
Yeah, definitely. This is an X-rated podcast.
Funny you should say that, because this week, my good news story is really good news for you personally, Katie.
Is it?
Okay, well, it's Parisian news. And drum roll, please. So a nudist restaurant has opened in Paris.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, can you add in the cheering noise there? Yeah, thank you. Now, to answer your inevitable questions, yes, they do wipe down the chairs between sittings. And yes, they do have curtains. And no, it isn't designed for anything untoward. No funny business.
Pure sausage eating.
Yeah, I don't think it's just sausages.
I don't know why I said that.
Anyway, I mean, I don't know why I've made this the happy story. Maybe they were slim pickings this week, but I thought it was like a fun story at least.
Well, I feel like it's happy news for you specifically because we've talked about this between us quite a lot, but you live in Amsterdam where there's a lot of naked spa going, right? Like, you might go at the weekends to a swimming pool with your friends and it'll take your clothes off. And that is a perfectly normal way to spend a Saturday in the Netherlands.
Yeah. And I'm sure many of our Dutch listeners will think, yeah, and?
And as you know, Dominic, I kind of have mixed feelings about this. I have tried it a couple of times. And I've always come away feeling kind of ambivalent about it. I don't mind it. It's more just the idea of kind of sitting down where someone else has been like 5 seconds before. But that isn't an issue in the restaurant because they're going to change the covers on the seats.
Oh, I thought they were wiping it down.
No, they're putting the covers on. I should confess, I do know all about the story.
Oh.
Because I am a journalist in Paris, so I wrote about it, obviously. But no, you're right. It's a very happy story, specifically for nudists in France. They're very, very excited.
I have to admit, I partly put this in because I feel like it was a diplomatic thing, because I have a bit of a difficult past with the French nudist community, in that I've told Katie this before, but I had a run-in with some rather aggressive French nudists on a beach at the Calanque last summer.
Tell us what happened with the
nudists. Well, okay, I accidentally swam onto a bit of rock that apparently is
nudist
only for
rock.
Nudist people. And I was with loads of colleagues, and we were like, oh, should we get naked? And then we're like, no, we've only met like a week ago and we're working together. So we just like walked up and down the beach, as you do when you've swum to a beach. And then they started circling us.
Like sharks?
Yeah, it was really scary. And they started chasing us off. First they started shouting at us that we should take our clothes off. Then we said, no, it's fine, we'll leave. And we started leaving and they started clapping and my friend fell over and quite seriously cut his hand open.
Oh my God.
Laughed and clapped even more. So that was quite a horrible situation. And maybe the fact that they've now got a restaurant that's for them in Paris means that they won't have as much pent up anger. I mean, I'm not suggesting that the whole nudist community is as angry as that.
Well, we did interview a bunch of nudists in this restaurant. And just to clarify, it's not supposed to be a restaurant for committed nudists, it's kind of anyone who wants to go naked.
Really? I kind of find that stranger.
Well, I think the clientele is probably going to be mostly committed, possibly older nudists. But the ones that were in there looked absolutely delighted to be there and just saying things like, you know, well, obviously you can go to the beach in France. There are actually 460 different nudist locations around the country. Did you know that?
No, I did not.
It's a lot. It's really one of the top nudist holiday destinations in the world. Campsites, beaches, stuff like that. But until now there hasn't been a restaurant where you can go in there and have a nice hot plate of gravy and eat it in your birthday suit.
Do you know if they specifically pick foods that like aren't gonna, like they wouldn't do gravy, because surely
I was gonna
if you spilt it, or a bit of soup What? On your bare chest.
Oh, I wasn't even thinking of the chest.
Or somewhere else. Katie, we don't want to lose our iTunes like clean podcast rating.
I'm not sure we have one of those. We're going to lose it very quickly.
We do, I saw it.
Do we?
Yeah.
Well, that's going to be short-lived.
Yeah.
I don't know how I feel about it. I think it is nice for the nudists. It's been opened not by committed nudists, but by a couple of kind of canny businessmen. A couple of identical twins, actually, who used to work in insurance. And now they're trying to make some money out of the quite large nudist community in Paris.
Wow. I'm surprised you didn't get there first, Mrs. Smelling the Money. That's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening to our first full episode of The Europeans. We've got a few thank yous to the wonderful Jim Barn for creating our absolutely amazing theme tune. He's available for any film music and musical theatre writing if you've got enough money, because he's very successful these days. And who else we need to thank, Katie?
Everyone who's appeared on this podcast so far. Thank you, lovely guests. And we'd love to hear from you guys as well. Thank you to everyone who subscribed so far, and if you've got a second to spare, we would love if you could go in the iTunes store and give us a nice big fat 5-star rating, because that will really help people to find the podcast.
Also, please follow us on Twitter if you don't already. It's at Europeans Pod. You can find us on Facebook if you type in The Europeans, and our email address is europeanspodcast@gmail.com.
Why is that Freudian?
I don't know.
Please let us know what you thought of the podcast. And if you've got any ideas of things that we should be covering, give us a shout.
Until next week. Dewey, Katie.
Au revoir.
But I think we have a new segment for our podcast. I think now every time we have a guest on, we have to ask them for a tongue twister in their mother tongue.
I like that.
Bless you.